the mother lamb.
I go passes another.
Yeah,
only place I find that they have extra money.
So what is the Terminator going to do next?
Remember that in 8-7 years ago, that was first been the model.
They cannot be used for personnel or travel or things like that.
Oh, they're willing to depart you.
That's really well said. That is really well said. You're talking about the Democrats.
I think, Steve, before we get into the unfortunate things.
Last time it didn't show up, so. I have a question for you. Bruce, can I go to this one or are you for
me? Where are we?
What's about that? San Francisco. Do you want to raid?
I can tell you. All right, I know I had an agenda here somewhere.
He took mine.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, right?
You look hungry.
I miss you, the puppy.
I had a lot of stuff. I do a lot of phone calls. I told my buddy, I said, take care of Shalom.
Yeah, he told me.
Yeah, he's a nice man.
He's a very
about
nice
ready.
Man.
I think we're pretty close, huh? Okay. Good morning. We welcome to our Wednesday, May 12th meeting and / hopefully we don't need a May 13th meeting. We'll see how it goes today. In keeping the tradition alive, bad news, good news, or kind of silly news, there's no way we can not start this meeting without thinking of the Gulf oil spill, really and truly. It's not a memorial, but boy, it could feel like a memorial. Let me tell you, it just is pretty painful for everyone in America. So I don't know what the hell they can do, but they better keep trying, and I think they are. So that's one point there. And in a serious note, and to lighten it up a little bit, Vice Chair Young and I have been talking, and there's been a huge movement with the Food and Drug Administration over food safety, which we talked about a little bit recently, and I just got word last week. They had a hearing out here in Monterey, but they had a hearing in Maryland where they brought busloads of Amish farmers in because there's a big movement about not letting the Amish have their horses go to market anymore and buggies. So the bottom line is one very distinguished young Amish farmer got up, and it's unfortunately the rest of our audience is not here today, but kind of felt it, and I'm sure we've all felt this way, and he said, you know, I don't feel very comfortable standing before you here today. This is very awkward for me, and I would like you to kind of understand how you would feel if you came to my farm and I put you on a buggy and handed you the reins and hit the horse in the ass. That's the way I feel. So it's not a very comfortable situation for people testifying, but I thought that was a good way to start the day here. So anyway, roll call vote, please, Mary. Here.
I'm here and confused.
Here.
Here.
Mr. Schroeder? Dr. Singh?
Yeah.
Dr. Young?
Here.
Mr.
Mullen? Here. At this time, introductions, we have Tam in the audience, our state board member liaison. Come forward, please, Tam. Give us the... Maybe I should have had you start the meeting off with not so good news, too.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board, staff. My apologies for missing, I guess, the last few board meetings, but...
Never apologize to us, Tam, for all the work you do, please.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we have been busy in Sacramento doing some good things and some not-so-good things, but at our last board meeting last Tuesday, I think we took a significant step forward in finally adopting two policies that have been in the works for well over 5 years. One is the in-stream policy for in-stream flows policy for the Russian River area that was required by Assembly Bill 2121, signed by this governor in the very first few months of his administration. So it has taken a while. The second policy is, I think, is a great deal more interest to you, and that is the one through cooling policy. That one has also been in the works for quite a while. And I'm proud to say that we are now the first state in the country to have a statewide policy establishing best technology available as closed cycle cooling for existing power plants that uses once through cooling. And in our policy, we make that closed cycle cooling standard equivalent to a 93% reduction in intake flow rate. So that's a 93% reduction in the gallon per minute flow rate on a per unit basis. We've also, in the policy, established a track 2 for those who can demonstrate that they are, that it's not feasible for them to achieve that 93% reduction. And for track 2, they are required to achieve a comparable reduction, and comparable is defined as at least 90% of track 1, and that is also on a per unit basis. But in track 2, instead of having to decrease their intake flow rate, they have the option of using various structural or operational factors or controls in order to achieve that level of reduction. The policy sets compliance dates for all the plants, ranging from 2010 to 2024 for one of the nuclear facilities. The Potrero plant, which is in this region, was given the date of 1 year after the effective date of the policy. So I think, in essence, that would be the end of 2011 would be my estimate. We did hear from a representative from Potrero at the board meeting. We discussed that even though there is an agreement in place for the plant to hopefully be shut down by the end of this year, some operational issues have come up. And as of last Tuesday, it was not clear whether or not they would be able to achieve the end of the year compliance date. The policy also established requirements for nuclear plants to do some special studies, establish requirements for the formation of an advisory committee that includes the Coastal Commission, the State Lands Commission, the Air Board, the three energy agencies in California, as well as CAISO, to work together with the State Board to help on the implementation of this policy so that we can ensure great reliability as we proceed. And the policy also includes interim requirements that the power plants will have to comply with between now and when they actually reach compliance with the requirements of BTA. There was one other piece to the policy that was approved by the board. This piece was approved by a 3-2 vote. And this piece is that the state board decided that the state board would be the one issuing the individual NPDES permits to these power plants and not the regional boards. I think, to my knowledge, it's the first time where the state board has decided to issue an individual, or actually in this case, 17 to 19 individual NPDES permits. It is a departure, in my opinion. I think so far we've issued statewide general permits, but not individual permits. As someone who has written NPDES permits, I appreciate how complicated a task that is, how much work goes into that on the regional board staff, as well as the significant consideration that regional board members have to take into account when adopting these permits. And so I think this will be a tremendous challenge for the state board. We don't have all the details in place yet. It is my understanding that the initial thinking is that the state board will ask regional board staff to draft the permits, but then the state board will consider that, will take up those permits, will consider those permits in a hearing in the region. And my understanding of the intention of this was to ensure consistency in the implementation of the one-stop cooling policy. I was one of the two votes in opposition, but it is the will of the majority of the board. So we will do our best to carry forth. I have to say, I'm speaking personally as one board member. It concerns me because I think it blurs that line between the roles of the state board and the regional boards. I've always viewed the state board as providing, obviously, statewide oversight, providing statewide policy guidance, and issuing permits where appropriate on a statewide basis. So for us to actually, my words, assume the regional board's responsibility in issuing individual NPDES permit is a concern, but having said that, it is the will of the majority of the board, and we will find a way to proceed, and obviously we'll work with regional board staff in order to accomplish it. So that was the major item. One other thing I wanted to give you a heads up on, we did receive also last month a draft report from our science advisory panel for CEC's constituents of emerging concerns. This panel was formed after we adopted the recycled water policy, and they expect to finalize their report in June. But in this draft report, they've developed a framework, they call it, for prioritizing emerging contaminants. They identify actually three constituents that they believe needs to start being monitored and reported. And these three constituents are, the first one is a natural hormone, estradiol. The second one is is found in personal care product, triclosane, I believe. It's the constituents that are in antibacterial, stuff that we all use. And the third is near and dear to my heart. It's a food product, and it's caffeine.
I hide your cup for me.
So those are the three that, yes. Well, those are the three that our science panel feel that using their methodology of, detection in water, significant threat to public or aquatic health, and that there are acceptable methods with acceptable level of detection. Those are the three that they are recommending that we start requiring monitoring and reporting. Their recommendations also include guidance on how, where, when to monitor for CECs and how to interpret the results. They also have recommendation, obviously, on additional research and support tools that are needed in order to advance in this area. So they do have a draft report out right now. I believe the deadline for public comment has already passed. They plan to finalize it, submit it to the state board in June, and then the state board has committed to review the recommendations and then hold a public meeting in November of this year to discuss how we will implement those recommendations. And I'll just end on the news that is no news, and that is budget talks. As you know, they are still continuing the budget discussions in Sacramento. As of this week, Dorothy Rice, our executive director, has still been called into various committee hearings for testimonies. So our budget is still very much up in the air with a variety of issues still remaining open for discussion. Okay.
Questions for state board member? It's pretty much what we discussed here at our May chair's conference call. She actually almost gave my report, so thank you for that.
Didn't mean to steal your thunder, Mr. Chair.
No, please. But the other part was that our state board of chair's call is the EOs. I think we have two in the state have stepped down or retired or moved on. I don't know, Bruce.
Yeah, one has retired from the Riverside region, and the LA region executive officer has stepped down.
And the issue of hiring because of our situations with salaries and things like that.
On both of those areas, in the Santa Ana Regional Board, the assistant executive officer, Kurt Rotholt, has been appointed. And in the LA Regional Water Board, I don't know if it's been announced publicly, but I think they have asked one of their assistant executive officers to be interim EO as they go about the recruitment process. And I think last year or the year before that, we did attempt to address the EO's salary issue. There were obviously a lot of concerns there. We were able to make some headway, and now with the departure of two executive officers, we are making a second attempt. We hope that this attempt will be more successful because I believe we will be able to gather support from various stakeholder groups, especially in the LA area, because they're very concerned about filling these very demanding positions at the current salary structure.
Thank you. Good seeing you, Pam. And staff, may we get a report when it's out to the board members on that recent release, the draft report? I know Vice Chair Young has been very interested in that for many, many years.
On the CEC.
CEC. Yeah. I don't even know if it's printed anywhere or not yet.
Right. We can include that in the executive officer's report. Likewise, we can update you on the in-stream flow policy, how that affects this region. And while we don't need to address it right now, just to close the loop on the once-through cooling policy, as Tam mentioned, the Potrero Power Plant in San Francisco is one that's affected, that's in our region, and that has been controversial. There is another, the Pittsburgh Power Plant, and in fact, staff has a draft permit ready to go, and so we now have to figure out how we work that through, because State Board is in effect supposed to do the adoption, as Pam said, rather than us. So there are some challenges, but we have those two facilities that are in our region that are affected by that policy.
Could we get a copy of that policy in writing, or is it not put to writing yet?
Yeah, we'll see what we have available. We did see recently sort of a final draft version, because as Tam notes, there were some things that were decided at the day of the board meeting, and so trying to get that in a clean version. The other aspect to note is that because that is a policy that does need to go through the Office of Administrative Law, so that she noted the effective date is not yet established, and that would depend on when the Office of Administrative Law reviewed and considered, and whether there was any return to State Board for some modifications. So, but we do such service. We do have copies. So we'll make copies and get that out to you.
Thank you.
That's why we love having Tam as our liaison. Instant, right there. So, very good. So moving on, it's kind of a change the segue a little bit here, from the budget, but to a privilege we at the board have to give some distinguished awards out to well-deserving individuals of our staff here. And so if I may read it first from up here, the first one I'll go alphabetical here, Carmen Pulis. So Carmen is going to get this award for environmental scientists, a certificate of appreciation. And she has just demonstrated an extraordinary ability to work with folks in each of her assigned watersheds, implement basic water quality protections in those watersheds, and explain the reasons why we're working to protect their water quality. So this is just very, very special. So again, as I say, it's our privilege from the board to present this to our staff. I wish it could be more, but this is something. Just go easy on us poor coastal people, Carmen, please. She does a great job. She is always out there in the fields and working hard. And the next one, going down the alphabet here, is for Melinda Wong. And she has demonstrated a fantastic ability to work both in satisfying the public, which is quite an accomplishment in this day and age of public and government, in their file reviews and information requests, and also assisting the board staff and helping them to get their information out quickly and efficiently. So again, it's very special. We offer this for Melinda Wong, a staff service analyst, a little certificate of appreciation. So thank you for all your extra hard work. That's some of the great fun times we get to have here at the board, and hopefully someday there'll be more out there for all of you that work so hard for us. Before I get too far away, I forgot my other note at the opening topic here, looking around at our desks here. We have a little over 8 pounds of paperwork today, and looks like it's almost 4 inches thick. So when people talk about paperwork and Paper Reduction Act, at this point it's not happening with us. So we keep printing it because we have to, correct? So does Mr. Jobs. We'd like you all to get everybody an iPad. So moving on to public forum. I don't have a card at this time, so Mr. Save the Bay, David Lewis, is not here, unless I have it stashed somewhere. So we will move on and do board member reports, and I don't think it'll...
Actually, we have the minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We have the minutes of the October.
That 8 pounds of paperwork has me stacked up here. So at this time, get back to my other agenda here. So we will... ask for a motion to approve the minutes of the October 14th board meeting.
And second.
Yes, second. And now the comments, please.
Yeah. You know, whenever a state board member attends our meeting, don't we recognize in these minutes that this person from the state board was present at the meeting?
We can do that. We can make
that
sure.
Recognize the minutes. So just as a courtesy said.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Any other comments, questions? If not, I will abstain because I missed that meeting, but if not, all in favor?
Aye.
So ordered. And
we missed you again.
Yeah. You're going to miss me at every October meeting, the way it's going. Thank you, Vice Chair, for handling that great day of the stormwater. And the storms did come, but they came nice and easy. We had one storm, a little dry weather, so.
We planned that.
That's right. Thank you, Lord. That's right. That vice chair. So moving on to chair's report quickly. We did have the chair's call here last Monday, week ago. And as I said, state board member made a lot of the comments that we all discussed. We have a very engaged and active group of chairs that call. It's unfortunate that we can't get together, but that's the way the budget crumbles. And had the privilege, again, also going with Bruce, our executive officer, over to the McBoy Ranch with the assembly member for the Marin County Environmental Breakfast over there. And without a doubt, and I know we've gone through a lot of permits with grazing and whatever, but Western Marin out there in the springtime is about a pretty place in the world, really and truly. Everybody was out eating their grasses and cows and everybody, and boy, we got to save that sanctuary out there. And this lady's ranch out there is pretty special, too. They do just some amazing environmental work out there, but I think she has some resources to pull that off. I wish I had. But great morning, great ranch. Had a great group of individuals attended the breakfast, so that was, again, a special treat for us to be over there. And that's all I have at this time. We can start down at the left here. All right.
Real briefly, I was wondering if Tam Dodick had heard about this, but I read this information recently published by the Water Environment Federation that California ranked number one in the nation efficiently spending the clean water ARRA funds. So I think it's worth celebrating and noting all the hard work that Water Board staff across the state they perform as well as many other folks. But collectively we should pat ourselves on the back, and we're all very interested in this issue of solving clean water issues, whether it's wastewater all the way to the bond funded programs that had been left high and dry. So that's let's congratulate ourselves and keep working toward putting those funds to good use for clean water. Thanks.
And I'll move down to Board Member McGrath.
Two things. I had the good fortune to attend a two-day workshop sponsored by the GS and ACDC on sediment, the state of the science in the Bay, which was truly excellent, and a lot of things that are very important to this board and to the health of our stream systems and our bay wetlands were discussed and are getting attention. And then I continued to tour other very attractive aspects of our region by bicycle. I went on the wine country metric century with a tailwind. Oh, it just doesn't get any better than that. But Sonoma County is just lovely this year, and crossing the Russian River in multiple locations, our hats are off to having some water in there. It's truly beautiful, and it does remind you of the stewardship that is being done by the agricultural community and the importance of preserving the resources that are there.
Would you like to display the monitoring device your family puts on you when you get out onto the water for all of us to see, since you were hiding it?
Well, no, I carry around a GPS system, so I can keep track of my tracks and how steep the hills are and the like. And but it's not one of those rest things that I mean, perhaps you had in mind. I'm not confined to a house.
But didn't you have one on the water?
I actually have. This is my track from last night. It's up to Treasure Island and back, and then back up to the top of the pier. So
you talk about someone checking the water out. There it is.
This is just to convince my wife that I really don't have a mistress.
I didn't go there.
I'm sorry.
Wasn't meant to be that discussion. So trust me, this stage, none of us will. Okay, so we'll move on here.
No possible comment after that.
Go ahead. Vice Chair, we'll let you clean up here. All right, so at this time...
I do have a few
items. Oh, that's right.
We got.
I know we're moving along quickly. Just to follow on Steve Moore's comment about the federal stimulus funding, as I noted in the package, I had a chance to speak at a celebration for completion of a project that was funded by the federal stimulus package out at Lake Merritt with the installation of the trash capture device. And it is significant, I think, overall, in that the federal stimulus funds have been able to be used, applied very quickly, and here's a case where the project is done and functioning. And as part of that event, the city was able to demonstrate to the media that was collected how the device works. They were able to, as part of the grant, acquire one of the large vector trucks that sucks out trash that's collected in these devices. And the head of the program at Oakland said, and I'm being very careful to say that this vector truck is dedicated only to this program, that the rest of the public works can't steal this away and use in cleaning the sewage lines and that sort of thing. It's only for the trashing. But it is very significant, and it ties into another thing I was going to bring up, is that these are projects that now, rather than define, gee, what is trash collection, why are we doing it, we're actually putting projects in the ground, and it's more directed towards, okay, what works better than others. We're getting past just the education, and that's similar to the point that Keith Lichten made. He was chair of the International Conference on Low Impact Development that was held in San Francisco recently, and one of the big points he made is that at this point we're no longer having to educate people on what is low impact development, why is that good. We've moved past that into, okay, how do the projects work, what works in your area, how can we continue to improve this. And that's really a step, a major step in sort of technology development, is when you get past just the basics and move into lessons learned and trying to improve the technology step by step. So I think we're really demonstrating a lot of progress being made. I also wanted to note that I put in your agenda packages a handout that was produced by the San Francisco Joint Venture. The Joint Venture is a longtime organization that's one of 18 joint ventures established around the country to address habitat needs, predominantly for birds, but all aspects of habitat are part of that. And the joint venture is just what it says, a mix of state, local, federal agencies, stakeholder groups, even corporations involved, all with a common goal of trying to see how we can protect and restore the habitat, in this case, the habitat for the bay. And so there are a number of things in there that the joint venture works as a group to carry out, and it's really a strong organization that we're happy to be supportive and part of. One of the things they're doing is they provided funding to technical organization PRBO, formerly Point Reyes Bird Observatory. They branched out far enough, so they changed their name to PRBO. I'm not sure who was in charge of marketing to come up with that decision, but at any rate, they've been doing a lot of technical work on the potential impacts of sea level rise on the San Francisco Bay estuary, and under different scenarios, what that would mean to wetland habitat, and then under different scenarios, what are the sediment needs for certain areas to ensure that we would continue to have a mix of habitats and that we wouldn't lose all of that. And so they're close to completing this. We saw a draft at a recent meeting. They're close to completing this, and it will provide a number of online query tools that you can say under different sediment scenarios or sea level rise scenarios, what is it we really need in certain areas? Where will we have just open water? Will we have high marsh, low marsh, or just what? And so that will be a very strong planning tool that would be useful to all of us who are working to protect the estuary. So that's something that's come out of the joint venture, that we're pleased with that. Finally, I will note that the ongoing saga of the mothball fleet, from at least the litigation side, is essentially reaching closed because the consent decree that we spoke of last month now has been entered in the court, and so that essentially implies it's enforceable. But we're also happy to see that the Maritime Administration has been proactive in moving forward with what they've been required to do. Just last week, they moved the seventh ship out of the fleet into dry dock in San Francisco for cleaning. So they are making good progress there. And as we noted in there, we have issued our water quality certification for dredging at the Mare Island dry docks. And that, I understand, will be also considered by BCDC at next week's meeting. So we're moving close to getting those dry docks up and running so that they can be part of the solution for the mothball fleet. So with that, I'll wrap it up so we can get into our action items.
Board member,
one quick question on your report. I note the electronic reporting system and the comments that were made there, and especially the comment that California is very far behind in this effort. I'm wondering if it would be possible at some future board meeting to have a brief report by staff on where we are, what we're doing to close that gap. It's an incredible burden on business having to do this by hand, and we've seen this in many of the meetings that we've had. So if we could do that, I think it would be very helpful.
Yeah, we can. We, in fact, the things over the last 10 to 15 years we've been able to do in this region with electronic reporting really lead the state and to a certain degree to the country. So we'd be happy to give you an update on that.
And I had something to that. Bruce called me yesterday and mentioned about electronic reporting. I think all the ACLs and all the time they are late. It can be simplified, the procedure, but especially for small businesses. It's a lot of burden, and I'm so glad that Gina Kakuya and Johnson Lab there, they made a presentation, but the presentation should be made to the businesses, I think. All the business, all the reporting agency, all the NPDF we have issued, those agencies should be, those organizations should be gotten together here, and presentations should be made to them so they can take benefit of these devices.
Well, we have been doing some outreach on all these programs, and we can update you on what that.
Okay,
that
thank you.
Okay, so just a little groundwork for today here for the board's procedures today. What we'd like to do is we'll do a swearing in now, and then we'll hear some items, and then around 10:45 or so, we'd like to take a 15-minute break or so. The vice chair, myself, and legal counsel would like to visit together a little bit, and then we will have a break there, get back, do another swearing in, and then also we'll work a little bit and get through some of the items, and then we'll see about a lunch break for everyone, and then hopefully we'll be able to continue on and finish up the day today and not have to continue tomorrow. So that's our hope and plan, so the board will go along with that. So at this time, we'll do a swearing in for who's in the building at this time. All relevant evidence which any person desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing, first by the board staff, secondly by the discharger, third by public agencies, and fourth by any other interested persons. The board and staff counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examination of any witnesses by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, address, and whom he or she represents. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rule of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony which is reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibit, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of this proceeding. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those wishing to testify in the hearing will now rise, please. Do you promise to tell the truth?
So do.
Thank you. So we'll put this close by here.
Next on our agenda are the uncontested items. We actually have two calendars on that. One would be the uncontested non-enforcement items, and then we have one item as uncontested enforcement. So we need to consider the non-enforcement uncontested calendar first. There is, I don't know if it's in your packet, there is a supplemental for item 5A, the Town of Yountville item. I'm not aware of at least any...
We have one card. Okay. I'd like to speak on it.
But 5A is the only one we have a supplemental on, or any changes that need to be made. And with that, I'd recommend adoption of the uncontested calendar.
Yes.
Mueller, yes, I need to recuse myself from items 5C and 6A due to a potential conflict of interest.
I have a question on 5A. It is not controversial question, it's informational. You know, you are saying that does not fully use the assimilative capacity of the river, Napa River. They're only discharging Napa River something like 0.08.
Maybe we should get into the motion that we could have a discussion on it. Or how do you want to do that?
Yeah.
I'd also like to recuse myself from 5A. I've contributed money to the veteran.
Okay, so we have two recusals, and then I'll get back to you, Dr. Singh, here. So first motion would be to approve the uncontested non-enforceable items first.
Also move.
Is that correct? Legal stamp?
Second.
But I do have a question on 5A and 5C. Let's start with 5A. As many of you know, I kind of look for early warning signs of sewer overflows specifically, and I noticed two very good things on this. First, I noticed that there is, in fact, a sanitary sewer overflow sewer management plan required, and I applaud that. But I also noticed that the flow on this was pretty high, 175 gallons per day. And back when I used to do this stuff, we used to figure a rule of thumb of about 100, and when it gets over 150, there's usually some reason for it. So it doesn't appear to be causing a problem, but it's just one of those things that caught my eye. So I wonder if there's a simple explanation for the relatively high flow.
Well, we have a motion and discussion, and then we will bring before we vote on the motion, we'll bring the speaker forward.
Yeah, I think that would work. And actually, since there are representatives of the town here, they're probably in a better position to address that.
Sure. So we'll move over to Board Member Singh and your comments on...
You know, my comment was that they're discharging into the Napa River 0.08 million gallons per day of treated wastewater. I mean, that's not going to overload the assimilative capacity of the Napa River. I mean, you included a comment about that. Is that reaching that level, that assimilative capacity is being challenged? I mean, or this question for information?
Well, that is something we've had to evaluate, because there are two permitted discharges, Calistoga and St. Helena, upriver from Yountville, and then there's the city of Napa downriver. And so staff has gone through, based on the comments received, and done evaluation and provided basically a level of dilution, and done evaluation to say that this is protected, that trying to look at, okay, we have to provide the ability for, if we're going to allow discharge into Napa River, we have to consider the impact or potential impact of the upstream and this, and then as it works its way down through Napa into the bay. It is a challenge. It's not only here in Napa River. We've had the same issue in some of our other North Coast creeks, but it's something that we've been able to evaluate. And based on that, even though it sounds like the flow is very low, it's the basis why we have a dry weather prohibition for each of these discharges to Napa River, Sonoma, Petaluma area, because the Napa River really is not much more than a creek in dry weather, if that. And so It's been an ongoing challenge for this board to try to address this throughout these areas, and we're pleased that, the town is, has actually done quite a good job at, being able to not only store but reclaim and reuse so much of their, effluent. And so rather than just be burdened of, trying to store all this, they're putting it to good use. And so that's definite progress.
And one more question about item number 6, because it is together. You have said something about seed and deceased order, and apparently they are upgrading the plant.
So right. They're,
why have you a seed and deceased when they are already upgrading the plant according to your requirement?
The Novato Sanitary District indeed is doing a major upgrade. However, at this point, until that, upgrade is complete and the plant is fully operational and tested, there are some constituents that they are not able to achieve their final effluent limitations. And so that is why the cease and desist order provides a series of tasks which we are, confident they're going to be able to achieve, but it still sets out the task for them to come into compliance with their final effluent limits. They're very close to doing that. The, plant upgrade, the construction work is scheduled to be done by the end of the calendar year, and then the implementation, bringing the plant online and, testing it, should be done by the middle of 2011. So it's, I would say this is more of an administrative requirement, because right now there's the potential that they could be violating their final effluent limits. So that's why we've gone through the action of proposing a cease and desist order with a task schedule in it. You may note that in that task schedule there actually are some tasks that have been completed, and so we are giving credit for that.
Thank you.
Okay.
I also have a question about 5C. This is the first time since I've been a board member that I've seen such a shallow discharge. It's actually across the mudflats at very low tides. And while the reclamation and, treatment records are very good, there wasn't much commentary on whether or not there were any issues associated with such a low discharge. So I'd like to the staff's view on that, whether or not any consideration of an extension of the outfall might be appropriate.
Well, that has been an issue, not only at Novato. Los Colinas is the next wastewater treatment facility just south of Novato, and San Pablo Bay is very shallow in those areas. But that is why, for Novato, there are restrictions on dry weather also. But again, staff has done the evaluation to go through and determine what is the potential impact at that mouth of that outfall. Typical design of outfalls is done in a way to try to diffuse or immediately cause that discharge to get maximum dilution within a very small zone. Obviously, when the outfall is exposed at, low tide, you're not getting much dilution. So that's something we've evaluated to see if there is an impact there. And essentially, the recommendation is that with the current design and with the current limits, once they complete their upgrade, they will able to achieve those limits and be protective of the discharge.
So in this case, rather than approach it with dilution, we're approaching it with higher level treatment.
And more, not only higher level, but the plant, in fact, the sanitary district at one time had three different plants, then they're down to two, and they found that they can't consistently meet the requirements by having this bifurcated system, and so they've essentially finally consolidated all their treatment at one, which was really something we had recommended to them probably about 25 years ago. But in that way, it provides more consistent treatment and better protection, I think, in all that space.
Okay, I didn't necessarily want to articulate a viewpoint that we should chew up the mud flats to extend the outfall. I just want to make sure that we're thinking it through.
Yep. Yep.
Any other questions? Any other comments from the board? So we'll bring our Town of Yountville Public Works Director forward. Grandma, work, please. The only card I have on this, and you might be able to respond to some of the questions and comments.
Morning, Chairman Mueller, board members, staff. My name is Graham Wadsworth. I'm the fortunate to be the Public Works Director at the Town of Yountville in the Napa Valley. I wanted to come to speak today to thank the board and staff for working with our town staff and consultants on this permit. This has been a very good process, and we appreciate the give and take that's been going on. Back in the mid-1970s, the town entered an agreement with the California Department of Veterans Affairs to take over operations of the wastewater treatment plant there, so that it would also be treating town effluent, wastewater, and the veterans home. About a third of the population in town is veterans and ratepayers. Also as part of that project, a recycled water line was built from the west side of the Napa Valley, where the plant is, to the east side of the Napa Valley, where there was demand for the effluent during the summer months for the wineries. Recently, a couple years ago, we entered another agreement with the Mondavi Vineyards to take water during the winter, which is when we have the most water effluent to get rid of. They have storage ponds, and so that water is being stored in those ponds. We were able to recycle 85% of all the effluent from the town and the veterans home in 2009. Unfortunately, we do have wet, warm winters like this year when there's not a lot of frost protection that's needed and their storage ponds are full from all the effluent and the water and rainwater. So we will still need a permit in the future. So we hope that we can go through a similar process in about 5 years on our next permit. So I do want to thank you for the board and the staff for working with us and our consultant. Thank you. Are there any questions?
I had to chat about the rather high per capita wastewater generation.
Well, the veterans home was built over 125 years ago, and they have a INI inflow infiltration problem. They are addressing it. They're working with the Government Services Administration in the state to get funding to disconnect roof leaders to address storm drains connected to the treatment plant. About half the flow of the treatment plant comes from the veterans home, and it's only a third of the population. So it is being addressed. The town's been addressing INI as well. To address your question about sewer overflows, we've only had one sewer overflow in the last 5 years. It was because our electricity went out, and until our guys get out there to turn on the generator, we had a minor overflow.
Okay. As long as it's been identified and it's being worked on, that's satisfying the question.
Okay. And the town did just last month approve our sewer system management plan.
Any other questions? Speaker, thank you.
Thank you.
I think between, well, both this and in Novato, I mean, people have spent tens of millions of dollars on this, and we go through this all the time, and it's kind of near and dear to our heart as we, in our city, raised our sewer rates last Tuesday night and started the dialogue of increasing them quite significantly. And I kind of framed it this way to the public, which I don't know if they appreciate it or not, but... In my opinion, police, fire, freshwater, and wastewater are our top four priorities in civilization here. And boy, if we cannot come up with a way to pay for our wastewater treatment, I don't know what's going to happen. So we are raising our rates. I know it's not a very popular thing to do, but someone's got to bite the bullet and make tough decisions. So sorry for the little comment there. But so if we have...
And also, just to back up there, Chair Mueller, in the case of Yountville, it's inspiring to me to hear about 85% reuse. I mean, that's very significant. And I don't, as a board member, I don't want to send the message that, oh, well, we're going to require that of communities because of the factors, natural factors you've identified in terms of, you know, sometimes there's going to be more water than can be managed. And so that's why we have a high level of treatment to both protect the environment, but also make this a viable water resource for reuse and to offset potable supplies and all the demands that are on those fresh water. So I think it's just a hats off to your community for pursuing that and showing that it can be done. Thank you.
Yeah, congratulations there. So we have a motion and a second, and we've had our discussion. And staff's recommendation would be to continue on to approve this at this time, right?
Right, noting that 5A has a supplemental,
right.
And that we have recusals from Board Member Peacock on 5A. And
so why don't we do 5A first, and we'll get that out of the way first. So roll call vote, Mary, for 5A, please.
Mr.
Eliyahu? Aye.
Mr. McGrath?
Aye.
Mr. Moore?
Aye.
Mr. Peacock?
Abstain.
Mr. Schroeder?
Aye.
Dr. Singh?
Aye.
Dr. Young?
Aye.
Mr. Miller?
Aye. Okay, so moving on to the rest of the uncontested, is that correct, uncontested calendar? I'm sorry, 5B and 5C, and then we go to 6. I'm sorry. So 5B and 5C, a motion and a second, please, on that one.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved to second. Any discussion on 5B and C? If not, roll call vote, please, Mary.
Mr.
Ariadne? Aye.
Mr. Moore?
Aye.
Mr. McGrath?
Aye.
Mr. Moore?
I'll recuse, please.
Mr. Peacock?
Aye.
Mr.
Brother?
Aye.
Dr. Singh?
Aye.
Dr. Young?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, so we're down to 6.5 pounds of paperwork here. So moving on to
the and the item contested calendar
six.
For enforcement 6A is again for the Novato Sanitary District, and as I responded to Board Member Singh, this provides a series of tasks that's tied into the permit you just approved, but it's also tied into the construction of their upgraded facility. With that, I'd recommend adoption of that calendar item 6.
And I'll so move.
Second.
Moved and second. Any further discussion? If not, roll call vote, please.
Mr. Eliyahu?
Aye.
Mr. McGrath?
Aye.
Mr. Peacock?
Aye.
Mr. Schroeder?
Aye.
Dr. Singh?
Aye.
Dr. Young?
Aye.
Mr. Moore?
Aye. Okay, so we've worked our way to item 7, Jan.
Item 7 is a testimony hearing on proposed basin plan amendment that would add a number of surface water bodies to the basin plan and designate beneficial uses for both those surface water bodies and a number of water bodies that are already in the basin plan but do not have designated beneficial uses. So I'd like Jenna to make the staff presentation and a reminder that since this is a testimony hearing, there is no action on this item today.
Start at the beginning. Okay. Good morning. I'm Jan O'Hara, an engineer with the TMDLM Planning Division. This item, as Bruce said, is the first of two hearings. It's a testimony hearing today, so you'll have a chance to hear from stakeholders and plenty of time to ask us questions and stakeholders as well. The item before you is a proposed basin plan amendment that would update the list of water bodies in our region for the first time since the basin plan was adopted in 1975. At that time, the basin plan was really a groundbreaking accomplishment, but it was also meant to be a living document. So this item is a significant effort to update the basin plan with new information about water bodies and beneficial uses. So clearly, one of the main purposes of this amendment is to update the basin plan. We want the board, staff, and the public all to have access to current and unambiguous information. We're also adding clarity by identifying more water bodies and stating their beneficial uses.
And to give you an example of how the basin plan isn't real clear right now, we hear from people when they're referring to water bodies that either aren't on the basin plan or they're on there but don't have any beneficial uses, people will say, well, there are no uses of that water. And that's not correct. Also, we aim to increase efficiencies with this amendment because the current practice of determining beneficial uses when they're not identified in the basin plan is inefficient. The board recognized these issues and prioritized this project in both the 2004 and 2009 triennial reviews. And actually, board member Steve Moore remembers initiating this project in 2003. He started out the work and we built upon it. We had to do other things for a while, other priorities, but we put our resources back into this project. We think it's really important, and we're here today.
We didn't realize there was child labor at the state at that time there.
Yeah, he was precocious.
I couldn't get anything done.
He got a lot done. Okay, it's not our purpose here to create beneficial uses. The amendment follows Clean Water Act guidelines for designating beneficial uses that exist or have existed since 1975. So we're not creating, but rather clarifying what uses exist. This proposed amendment would modify Chapter 2 of the Basin Plan. And Chapter 2 is all about beneficial uses of the waters in our region. Surface waters, groundwaters, wetlands. Today we're only talking about surface waters. Chapter 2, along with Chapter 3, which is all about water quality objectives, forms the water quality standards that we have to attain under the Clean Water Act. The proposed amendment includes the elements listed here. 280-plus water bodies are added to Table 2-1. And examples of water bodies that we've added include Oakland and Richmond Harbors and San Leandro Bay, all real busy water bodies. It includes Saucel Creek, which still has migrating salmon, Hayward Shoreline Marsh with its numerous rare species, Kirker Creek, we recently added that to the 303D list of impaired water bodies, and lots of sloughs all around the bay margin. So another element is beneficial uses are designated for the new 280 plus 100 odd water bodies that are on Table 2-1 now without beneficial uses. It includes that maps are updated, and I'll give you a bit more on that, and of course the revisions to Chapter 2 text. So let's talk about these updated maps. The basin plan now contains 7 maps, one for each of our hydrologic units. Central Basin is shown here. We're adding water bodies, of course, to all 7 basins. In 2005, staff put in a lot of work and effort in updating basin plan maps with GIS and with work that the Oakland Museum did on mapping water bodies all around the bay. The proposed amendment would further update these maps by delineating or labeling all of our new water bodies. To get adequate resolution, we're upping the number of maps in the basin plan. There are 7 now, and there would be 18. We think these newly updated maps would be a great resource online for our local creek groups and all the other stakeholders. But where we're going is we hope to one day have just one large map of the basin plan online with lots of layers of information that you can get at a click of a mouse, like beneficial uses, impaired water bodies, even swamp data. So that's where we hope to go with the maps. Now the central basin here, I'd like to talk about how, here we go, it's a good example of where we added water bodies. Because, for instance, here in the East Bay, none of these water bodies, except for Berkeley Park Lagoons, are currently on the basin plan. So we're adding all of this Richmond Harbor and all of these creeks. And here in northern San Francisco, just a little tip of the peninsula, we're adding all the one that was here. So there's a few more to be spoken for, and San Francisco isn't really totally all paved. So we think it's important to show those things. Okay, so far I've talked about adding water bodies and map updates, two of the elements, and now I'd like to talk about how we designated beneficial uses. And beneficial uses are the beneficial ways water is used by humans and wildlife. I'm going to quickly touch on each of the beneficial uses that are part of this project and then add a couple more details on a couple issues after that. All water bodies, be they salty or fresh, got these three beneficial uses: wildlife habitat, Water Contact Recreation, called Rec 1, which is recreation where ingestion of water is likely, like swimming, fishing. And non-contact water recreation, we call Rec 2, and examples of that are picnicking, beachcombing, and aesthetic value, aesthetic enjoyment. So all fresh waters, like streams and rivers, were designated with warm freshwater habitat, and if evidence existed, they also were designated as cold freshwater habitat. So evidence of cold freshwater habitat includes published reports and a National Marine Fisheries Service database that tells the distribution of cold water species like salmon, steelhead, rainbow trout, and coho salmon. A stream can have both warm and cold because of temperature gradients. For the most part, we didn't try to segment streams into different reaches. We designated uses on the whole water body, with two exceptions, and that is tidally influenced waters like Napa River tidal, Napa River non-tidal, has two separate listings, different uses, and also creeks that have above dam and below dam would often get two listings. But other than that, not so much. Because the documentation doesn't exist to show which reaches of streams would have, say, cold water, where fish would be spawning particularly, it would be extremely resource intensive to try to gather all of that information to break into reaches. So we feel that being protective of uses throughout the watershed is the appropriate way to designate uses, and we find this is consistent with regions across the state. Yeah, the beneficial uses on this slide were designated on specific types of waters. Estuarine habitat found in the San Francisco estuary and tidally influenced rivers. Streams that discharge to reservoirs or wetlands were designated with freshwater replenishment. Ocean waters are identified as marine habitat. And reservoirs were designated as municipal and domestic supply, along with a couple North Bay creeks that are actually used as drinking water sources by municipalities. And the remaining beneficial uses shown here were designated only where documentation shows that they exist now or have existed since 1975. These include commercial and recreational fishing, and for that we looked mostly at California fishing game websites that talked about fishing opportunities or fishing licenses. The next is groundwater recharge. We primarily used the watershed characteristics report from the Santa Clara Valley. A good portion of our recharge is in the South Bay, and that was a good source of documentation. Fish migration we got from reports and databases. Navigation was based on NOAA nav charts. Preservation of rare and endangered species. Resource agencies provided most of the documentation for this, either staff or web-based information. And fish spawning, again, from reports and databases, pretty much the same ones for cold, spawn, and migration. Same reports and databases. So that's how we designated beneficial uses. And as I said, a couple of issues need further explanation, starting with why we designated warm, wild, Rec 1 and Rec 2 on nearly all water bodies. The rationale for these designations is the Clean Water Act rebuttable presumption, which says that wherever attainable, water quality, which provides for the protection and propagation of fish, shellfish, and wildlife, and provides for recreation in and on the water, will be achieved. You've heard of this as the fishable, swimmable waters goal of the Clean Water Act. And that's why we propose to designate warm for protection and propagation of fish, wildlife habitat for protection and propagation of wildlife, Rec 1 for recreation in the water, Rec 2 for recreation on the water, for all water bodies, virtually. We're being consistent with what's been done in other regions, and this approach is supported by the US EPA. The rebuttable presumption is about water quality. Although water quality must support these four uses, the four presumptive uses, when it comes to reservoirs, body contact recreation doesn't actually occur. You know that water supply agencies prohibit swimming and other activities to protect water quality for drinking water. Some agencies also limit public access to the entire watershed surrounding a reservoir, like this one here, Calaveras Reservoir. Even so, under the Clean Water Act, the water quality of these reservoirs must be protective of recreational uses. Currently, our basin plan designates Rec 1 as limited or existing for reservoirs. There's a little mix. Some are limited, some are existing for recreation in the water. And in the basin plan now, limited is not defined, but we all pretty much understand what that means. What we propose to do is to designate Rec 1 as E-star for reservoirs to indicate that Rec 1 exists, but barriers to recreation are in place. This convention is consistent with other regions, most of the regions across the state. By doing so, we're not saying that the public should be allowed access to reservoirs. And that brings me nicely to the comment letters we received on the proposed amendment, because we heard from four water supply agencies who are all listed here who object to the E-star designation for water contact recreation. They're concerned the public will perceive that swimming and similar uses should be allowed, and that public pressure to allow swimming will increase. They already have pressure like that from various public groups. Also, by saying that Rec 1 exists when recreation in the water is not allowed, these agencies think that we're not clarifying the basin plan, which is one of our objectives. But please note, the agencies don't object to the application of the bacteriologic water quality objective to reservoirs. Their concern is only that people may feel increased access is warranted based on seeing the E in the Rec 1 column. So we stand by our designation of Rec 1 as E-star for reservoirs. I repeat that this is consistent with other regions across the state. However, we do agree with the commenters that the explanation of E-star in the basin plan text and how it means that this is a water quality, not a physical access requirement, this could be expanded in the basin plan text, and we plan to do that. Two stormwater programs, San Mateo and Santa Clara, and Santa Clara's legal counsel, object to our broad application of Clean Water Act presumptive uses. Instead, they ask that we show documentation for every use. The programs particularly do not think that Rec 1 applies to all creeks. They say that people aren't swimming or wading in those creeks. We stand by our designation of presumptive uses in similar fashion as we do for the reservoirs. However, the programs did submit some information about specific creeks, Ross, Canoas, others, and we'll look at information that they've submitted to us. The stormwater program's concern is that the broad application of Clean Water Act presumptive uses will result in compliance issues. Under the Clean Water Act, though, the presumptive uses have existed on all these water bodies, whether or not they were stated in the basin plan. So we're not changing applicable water quality objectives. The programs also ask that we take the time to designate uses on a reach-by-reach basis rather than on the entire water body. Again, their concern is potential compliance problems. We don't agree that adequate information exists to assign beneficial uses to some creek reaches and not to others. Also, we expect to be practical in any potential impairment listing. For example, we would monitor cold water temperatures in creeks in the upper reaches of the watershed where we would expect to find cold water species, not in the lower reaches. In its letter, the US EPA expressed support for the proposed amendment and designation of presumptive uses to virtually all water bodies, and asked that the basin plan text be clearer about how we that the only way to remove a beneficial use is by de-designation. We agree with them, and we will make sure the text is clear on that. And lastly, we got a lot of good, helpful information from some of the other commenters that are listed here. They gave us specific instances where we've gotten spellings, we've got creek names wrong, we've got, in the case of City of San Jose, we misplaced the creek into the wrong slough, or we switched slough names. All of that's really helpful. You know, there are 400 or 500 water bodies being looked at here, so we really appreciate when people helped us with some of those specific comments, and we feel like we can make the changes they suggested. Okay, in the coming weeks, we'll be preparing responses to all the written comments and to all the comments that we hear today from you and the stakeholders. And we'll make revisions to the amendment and staff report based on those comments. We'll be bringing the revised proposed amendment back to you in July for consideration for adoption. And that concludes my presentation. We'll be happy to take your questions.
Any questions have Jan at this time?
Everybody got questions on this one. But
bring your mic in, Dr. Singh, please. Yeah, you could ask questions of staff.
You know, I agree with many of the comments you have received. First of all, some of the creeks are simply drains or ephemeral. They don't have water in the summertime. And they are just listed tiny, tiny creeks. The name is creek, but probably they should be called drain. And there is no beneficiary that dangerous. Some of the sloughs along the bay, they are not approachable. And dangerous to reach there. So I think it's nice to open a dialogue, collect data, but I do agree that even big creeks like Kaivoti Creek in our area is not usable for beneficial usage in many regions. So probably you need a lot more work, a lot of data collection to designate for what use, what creek, what reservoir. Some of the reservoirs which are especially for potable water, especially connected with treatment plants, water treatment plants, they cannot be allowed to have body contact recreation, one or things like that. So I think this is nice to invite comments. This is a good goal, but what we have right now, probably out of 280 bodies you have listed, probably more than half of them you have to reject because they don't qualify for creek. Or they don't qualify for any. Some of the creeks are very deep, but barely there is any water, and it's very dangerous to get in there. So I think it's a good goal, but I would commend the staff that you've got a lot of work ahead of you before it can be implemented, in my opinion.
Okay, any other comments? We have a board member, Peacock.
Jan, and you listed 280 bodies of water. Are there a list of bodies of water that are not listed? So every single body of water in...
No, not every single body of water.
And
I'm Jan O'Hara. No, not every water body made it onto the list. Some were very small. What we tried to do is get geographic representation so that water bodies aren't all listed, but something near that would be. That would help in identifying beneficial uses for future for bodies that aren't on the list.
Well, I guess if you look at the inverse of it, do you have a list of the bodies of water that you are excluding from this?
No, I don't have a list. There's many creeks with no names. There are creeks that I could list that I know looked at and didn't put on. For instance, sloughs. Like if you look at this picture, well, this is all Newark Slough, but there are places where sloughs and sloughs and sloughs, and you might have six different sloughs, and so not everyone needed to be on the basin plan. So one or two would be on. So I could develop a list that I rejected. I don't have that list.
No, I'm not suggesting that. I'm just wondering how you arrive at the determination that one goes on and one does not.
Well, that's a good question. So we tried to get geographic representation so that there weren't bare spots, which is what I showed in that central basin map. We tried to make sure that all types of water bodies were represented. So previously there weren't too many sloughs. So we looked at adding a lot of sloughs and made sure there were all the main stems and then an assortment of the tributaries. And reservoirs were a little sparse before, too, so we concentrated on getting more reservoirs represented in the basin plan.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Vice Chair?
Yeah, I have a procedural question. I tend to come at this issue from the opposite direction of Dr. Singh, which is to be very comfortable with the presumption that any body of water that some kid might wander into should be have a rebuttable presumption that it would be fit for contact recreation. But having said that, I'd like to dig down a little bit into the comments that we received about people being concerned about compliance issues. And it seemed to me that what they were concerned about was that there might be a stream reach that really, for some reason, would be inappropriate for Rec 1, let's say. And they were concerned that there would have to be some expensive management as a result. Can you walk us through the process of what the board staff would do when faced in a, with a circumstance like that? But you know, what's the procedure that you that we would go through if we found ourselves in a situation where where we had the unintended consequence, let's say, having forcing a compliance issue where such as the ones that, that the commenters are concerned about? Trying to get a sense of how big a deal this is.
Right. We don't expect this to be a very big deal because you'd have a compliance issue if you had a particular discharge to a particular segment of a water body where you might have a problem. But in that event, you'd end up having to do some kind of a use attainability analysis. That is your way to de-designate the use. But we don't really expect this to be a big problem. We're not... we're looking at the full length of the water body and looking at issues that would be throughout the water body. So it's unlikely that one particular segment is going to propose an issue that isn't related to the downstream segments that we might want to be protecting.
All right, thank you.
We might have a comment or a comment on it also who's a water resource specialist.
Terry's question was exactly my question, and I would hope that the testimony focuses their viewpoint on that, because that's really what I want to hear today.
And I think it's also worth noting that just because there is a designated beneficial use, that doesn't in and of itself drive our regulatory program. The whole program of addressing impaired water bodies is really specific to lines of evidence that we collect over time to determine whether or not those water bodies are impaired for certain uses. And so that gets down to be very specific, much more specific than what this does here. And so a water body would not be designated as impaired unless we were able to demonstrate those various lines of evidence. And then based on that designation, that starts to derive the regulatory program through the development of TMDLs that you've been involved in and the implementation of the measures that are in those TMDLs. So this is a starting point. It essentially also addresses a number of instances where in the past we've had to rely on what's called the tributary rule, which basically says that if you don't have a designated beneficial use for a water body upstream, you rely on what's designated downstream. The 1975 Basin Plan in some instances is so vague that some of the creeks we've had to rely on the designation of the beneficial uses in the bay because that's the downstream water body we've identified, and that's clearly inappropriate. And so getting to Board Member Peacock's point is that, as Jan notes, there are some water bodies that really isn't appropriate to get down to such a level. There still is the tributary rule that should there need to be some determination, we can look at what's downstream. We're really trying to look at this on a watershed-wide basis.
I have a follow-up question here. Not a question, maybe it is a comment. You know, I'm familiar with two creeks in my area which I mentioned in your report, Ross Creek and Canoas Creek. And the Ross Creek is a drain, but I think it's man-made trapezoidal channel. And I have seen that because some people live in that area. They usually walk along the embankment, the people, for walking and hiking, like that. And I will not call it a water body. It is not a water body. Whenever there is a rain, there is a water there. You cannot have a fish in there. You cannot have any recreation over there. And it is dangerous. A Canoas Creek is kind of deep, but it's also the same. Ephemeral, sometimes some stormwater drains are connected with it, and it fills up the water, runs. Rest of the time, it is a dry creek or almost very little. So sometimes I was wondering, what is a water body? When I call it a water body, they call it a creek. A water body, is the designation right for that? But I was attempting to say over here, you can designate the beneficial use of a water body if it is a water body. Of course, if your definition is that during the storm the water is flowing through that and is a ephemeral river, that becomes a water body and then becomes a beneficial use. I don't know. I'm confused a little bit here. So what I was trying to say over here, that this is a great effort you are trying to, but a lot more data will be needed to justify even designating a beneficial use for this tiny, tiny, every little line you have on the map, you can put it on the list over there. That's what I was trying to...
Well, actually...
Yeah, let me just help answer that, too. I think Board Member Singh, with respect, there's some amazing legal cases out there regarding exactly what you're thinking, I believe. Is that correct? I mean, trust me, when there's a dry creek, we're all, there's a lot of opinions out there. Is this a water body? And if you want to hit a hot button with great-grandparents who live along a creek, have neighbor kids walk in the creek. Trust me, that's a hot button for everybody. But anyway, I'm sorry to get off.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And I guess the brief answer is, and there is a lot of legal work that has been done in terms of determining what are considered waters of the United States, and essentially anything at a minimum if it's what they call a blue-lined creek. In other words, if it shows up on a USGS map as with the blue line, that's going to be a waters of the United States, and in many instances even tributaries to that. So we're not necessarily in this determining what are waters of the United States. These are already waters of the United States, but we do have the responsibility to protect waters of the United States as an agency. So we're moving the issue past what's a water of the United States to designating the appropriate uses for those waters. And so that's really where we're getting at, because there's a long legal history that has identified waters such as Ross Creek and Canoas Creek as waters of the United States that we need to protect.
I'm a big believer, too, personally, that there are some reservoirs out there that I don't want the public in it. I'm sorry, I'll fight that one from my personal level all the way. And there's a couple big ones on the San Mateo Peninsula there that I think the public should stay out of.
Right, and again,
task on that one.
We fully agree, and in my mind, this is consistent with the approach we take, that this board is not a land use agency. And in the same way, we're not imposing any decisions on those bodies who own those reservoirs as to whether or not they allow access. That's not our call. We're just looking purely at the water quality aspects of the water in their reservoir or in the tributaries to that reservoir.
What if we hear this card from the water resource specialist and let them speak to it? I believe it's Xing Kong. Are you in the room? Yeah. With the Contra Costa Water District.
Hi, I'm Xing Kong with the Contra Costa Water District. Thank you very much to the staff and board for this opportunity to comment on the proposed basin plan amendment. CCWD had two comments to make.
May I ask you to speak up, please?
Sure. I realize I'm...
All right.
CCWD has two comments to make. The first is with regards to Mallard Reservoir, which is listed in the basin plan. And we would like to see Mallard Reservoir removed from the basin plan list of surface waters of the region. First of all, the listing is in error and has been since 1975. Mallard Reservoir was created as a forebay to the Contra Costa Water District Bowman Water Treatment Plant and is not a surface water of the region. It does not fall under the definition of water of the United States. It is not a surface water, estuarine wetland, estuarine water, or coastal water. It is, in fact, a man-made burned containment constructed on dry land well before 1972, and it does not impound any natural drainage, but receives water through a pipeline from Suisun Bay. Since Mallard is listed in error as a surface water of the region, we strongly request the removal of Mallard Reservoir from the basin plan. That was our first comment. And then our second comment was with regards to the proposed designation of attributing existing Rec 1 and Rec 2 beneficial uses to all water bodies. We believe that this proposed Rec 1 and Rec 2 beneficial use designation relies on an overly broad interpretation of the intent of Section 101A2 of the Clean Water Act. The Regional Board's staff cites this rebuttal presumption that fishable and swimmable uses are attainable for all water bodies. With regard to Mallard Reservoir, which is a forebay to a drinking water treatment plant, the California Health and Safety Code, Section 115825B, prohibits all body contact recreation in drinking water reservoirs. We believe that this the E-STAR designation, while we understand that it is the intent is to convey a water quality goal, the E-STAR designation is misleading in that it suggests an existing beneficial use where such a use has never been permitted or intended as a drinking water source. And so this E-STAR designation, we believe, runs counter to the stated goal of clarifying the basin plan. We would therefore strongly recommend the board to reconsider the use of assigning these Rec 1 and Rec 2 beneficial uses for all surface water bodies. I believe that captures all of our comments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A response? Someone to speak? No other cards.
Yeah, we can provide a brief response, but remember all of these,
right.
Your comments from the public
will
that we collect today will be addressed as
okay.
Along with all of the letters that you're in your packet. So we're required to do the response to comments.
Just want to say that in the case of Mallard Reservoir, it's potentially a unique circumstance, and we are looking into this a little bit because they've made some statements that it's not considered a water of the U.S. They've got some statements that have been made by the Army Corps of Engineers, and I've talked a little bit with EPA, so we'll be following up on that.
Some clarifications and
yeah.
A number of those, as you stated in your comments.
Okay.
Would it be fair to say I think this would be a separate action outside of the scope of this one, perhaps?
Well, we'll be looking into it between now and in our response to comments.
All right. There's no other discussion. This will be brought back to us. Eventually. Yes, board member?
Yeah.
At this moment. Okay. Board member McGrath.
My concern about this one gives me a lot of pause. And it really, I think, has to do with priority setting as to how much staff resources this warrants and whether or not it ends up increasing paperwork for little benefit or benefit that is not clearly in something that we would see as high priority. I'm not completely sure that some of the comments are merely awfulizing. The concerns, I think the staff had a very good response on the recreation and indicated that they're going to change the language and the explanation, and that satisfies me. But the stormwater concerns, I would like to see more fleshed out about what the potential concerns are and the like. I do represent water recreation users, kayaks, windsurfers, kitesurfers, stand-up paddlers. One thing that's very clear to me is those uses change over time. People are fascinated by water and they go in there. I watch the kids at Cal Day in Strawberry Creek. My grandchildren know where San Leandro Creek is, and they know they shouldn't go in there, but they're kind of fascinated. So what I want to... I think there's an endpoint that I want to be able to distinguish between discharges, where there's reason to regulate, and watershed modifications that may be mistakes of the past that leave us with little remnants of the stream. And I don't want to necessarily focus on those through anything triggered by this regulatory mechanisms. When water supplies are developed, there's supposed to be a consideration of a public trust, and maybe it wasn't sufficient, but there certainly is the ability in good governance to allocate public trust users to one of the uses, water supply, control of flooding, and the like. And as long as that was properly done and excluded public access, I don't want to re-enter that. So I don't want to create anything here that allows a re-entry to that. I don't think that's the appropriate use of the basin plan. So perhaps there just needs to be more explanation to me as a board member and the stormwater agencies that it's not creating that. And I want to take it back to the 30,000-foot level. I don't want to just regulate because we need to update the basin plan. I want to make sure that any regulation would end up focused on a priority. So that's my direction.
All set. Board member Moore?
Yeah. Lost my hat. So thanks for the really excellent staff report. I think the staff have captured a lot of the rationale here. So I want to throw my weight as a single board member behind this effort very strongly, not just because I worked on it and have a sense of what's at stake, or any sort of personal stake in it, but this, as was articulated, has been indicated as a top priority through public review of the basin plan for the last decade or more. So this responds to that interest in the public. I want to, there are some philosophical questions that have been brought up, and frankly, I think folks know I'm pragmatically minded about this kind of thing. I'm concerned about the unintended consequences of designating Rec 1 and strictly, areas that may, where it may not be appropriate. But I appreciate the response that staff has to that, and I'll provide a little illustration to maybe help articulate why it's warranted to go about things this way. First, and then, so when we talk about unintended consequences, I want to just respond strongly that there are unintended consequences of not going through this exercise that this agency has wrestled with for the last 25 years, and I've been in the thick of it. San Lorenzo Creek, a significant water body in the East Bay, is not in the basin plan. It's ridiculous, and it really puts the basin plan, it questions the credibility and how current the basin plan is. It undermines its regulatory authority to have such factual omissions. So, and I'll just remind the board members that really the issues here are not that controversial. Nobody's really come to this hearing except for this really important, good discussion about, where should water contact recreation be designated. I mean, really, we've narrowed it. We don't have anybody complaining about the fish, the idea of extending the fishing beneficial use to fresh waters in the region, which, by the way, is not in the basin plan now. You know that? So these are really important things to just get the facts sort of straight. And the point I'd like to make, too, is just to really acknowledge a shift since 1975 that's geopolitical in relation to the public's relationship with the water bodies of the region. And I think there are pivotal actors in that, Oakland Museum, the watershed forums of the Bay Area, whether in Contra Costa, Santa Clara, San Mateo, Marin, Solano, you name it, Alameda. And the geopolitical significance of creeks, sloughs, and lagoons today is a lot different than in 1975. The 75 Basin Plan, to give you a little historical perspective, really was geared toward regulation of wastewater, sewage, and industrial wastewater. So the water bodies in the list really reflect that. And now we have people that identify with their local creeks, but really have a deep sense of hurt that the governing bodies don't recognize specifically the name of that creek. And that's where, to Board Member Peacock's excellent question about where do you stop? And, you know, we've certainly wrestled with that, you know, at our staff level. And what we were faced with was an uneven distribution of water bodies around geographically. And I think you've done a really credible, defensible job of making the density of the water bodies in the basin plan more even. And that's a big starting point. But also being responsive to this very personal issue of the name of the place where I live and where the water goes over the land. And so I'd like also the board members and others to think through how these are implemented before rushing to concern about mandating, you know, public use of swimming in drinking water reservoirs. It's not how they're implemented. There's two legitimate concerns, you know, about, so at 303 delisting, I think staff have responded to that, that any kind of impaired water body exercise looks at the whole watershed. So, you know, these little pieces of creek aren't singled out for separate regulatory requirements. So that kind of concern in terms of practice is not warranted, because that's not how the agency operates. Simply because of resources, as Board Member McGrath brings up. But ultimately, discharge requirements that this board establishes, the real regulatory rubber hitting the road, have to meet water quality objectives. And those water quality objectives are based back on the beneficial use. That is where the rubber hits the road in terms of this regulatory action. So that's why a Rec 1 use established for Canoas Creek is relevant, because it's upstream of Guadalupe River, which has many locations of public contact. And it's appropriate to set discharge standards based on bacteria standards to meet water quality, you know, beneficial uses downstream in that same watershed. So that's if thinking through how it gets implemented, that's where it goes ultimately. So I think I've touched on that. There really is a rebuttable presumption in terms of how we operate. It's legitimate. It doesn't mandate any kind of land use. And then I would say, you know, it's to Dr. Singh respectively, it's not appropriate at this time to use current land use to dictate what you know, what recreation or such or other uses may happen in the future. And then I have to finally say, technically, a dry creek has water in it. It's got a hyporheic zone that supports riparian vegetation, supports whole ecosystem. So it's incredibly important to protect dry creeks in the state of California.
And very back, good.
I'll let it go.
Thank you, board member. That's why you're here. Good job. Board Member McGrath.
Just, I really appreciate Steve's comments, and one distinction that I would like to see show up in this, and it's a distinction I hold when I look at when you take out the regulatory tool set and when you take out the coalition building tool set, because they are really different. And preservation of a stream and a stream function, whether it's riparian vegetation, sediment transport, you know, the fact that there are kids in there, that's a legitimate regulatory function. Restoration of systems is a different kind of animal. It involves coalition building, funding. It's you're not going to accomplish it with your regulatory toolbox. And I want to see that clear distinction made because people will ask us to restore things with the regulatory tools, and they're just not well suited. But I do strongly agree with Steve that we need to get the beneficial uses right.
Very good. Thank you. Vice Chair?
Can I make a comment after hearing all the comments over here?
Okay.
You're not making a comment that quality of discharge into these creeks, even the stormwater discharge, should not be regulated. My comment was specific. That some of these creeks, we just can't designate that they are suitable for Lake 1 or Lake 2 or fish habitat or something like that. There are some, you can go to Ross Creek, there is no water, they're full of grass, tall grasses. And I'm very sure some kind of animals are there, including some snakes. So, I don't know what are there. And I'm just saying that some animals are probably living in the bush as well. But the water runs at a certain time when there is rain. So, I was not trying to say that don't make a vague designation that this should be used, this all the water bodies for all the beneficial uses. Just find where it is applicable and use that beneficial use. If you want to regulate the discharge and quality of discharge into this, that's a separate issue. But I have beneficial uses. When there is no water and only ephemeral rivers which they have water only for during the rain period, after that they are dry, I don't know how can fish can survive there. Forget about cold water fish, even the warm water fish. I'm talking about cold water, you need temperature gradient and constant water over there. So my comment was simply saying there is a lot more work of data collection. I designate the various reaches, as you have already indicated, that where are which portion of the river or the reservoir and which reservoir for what beneficial uses can be used and what cannot be used. Regulating discharge, I didn't make any comment on that one. I was simply saying this whole document designating all these so many rivers, creeks, sloughs, everything in one game, to me, it's just too broad and too vague, you know. That's all I was making comment. Steve Moore's comment, I understand. When I just regulate the discharge, because finally discharge going in Converse Creek is going to go to Guadalupe River, and that is going to affect something else. Now that's a separate issue.
Thank you, Board Member Singh. We could get into a House of Commons thing here. We could have a little excitement going here.
Yeah, we could have fun with it.
At least we don't yell at each other too much here. Good discussion. All right, Vice Chair.
We very respectfully disagree, and we'll go on with it. I would just like to respond to two points. First of all, on the issue of designating E star, it seems to me that the staff proposal of how to deal with that is very logical. It is clear to me, at least, what E star means. And I think with improving the explanation that is in the documentation, I think that will probably address the problem. Secondly, I also support the staff approach on interpreting the rebuttable presumption for the named surface waters as including Rec 1 and Rec 2 and WARM. I did notice that, and we've been discussing the issue of whether or not that is going to cause unintended consequences and whether or not it's going to make us and others use resources doing numerous use attainability analyses. I think that's a valid question. On the other hand, I noticed that with among all of the commenters that made that comment, not one brought up a specific example. So it's unclear to me whether, you know, as Jim says, this is awfulizing or whether this is a real issue. I would ask you folks to, in your response to comments, provide an explanation that would give us some more clarity as to how common an event you think this might be. if you think it's going to come up at all in the real world implementation. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. We better move on. We're getting pinched for time here a little bit. So I think you've heard loud and clear a number of viewpoints from not only the board, but also from the regulated community out there. So we'll be looking forward for some more updates coming up soon. All right. Thank you. We have one more item. Item 8. Are we all right, or what do we need?
Okay. And just to wrap up the item 7, we're noting that we do recognize there's a lot of work to be done and don't intend to bring that item back in June. However, when we initially put out the public notice, we did say we would bring it back in June. So we're wanting to go on record that it's not going to be in June. It would be July at the earliest, and we'll make sure we close the loop on our other public notice. And with that, before we get into the enforcement items, we do have one information item. This will be fairly direct, but I think it's a significant issue that merits bringing in front of the board, and I'd like Christine Boshin to make a presentation on it.
Thank you, Christine. As you're well aware, we're kind of pinched here for time, so.
Well, I practiced my speed speaking, so hopefully we'll go quickly. Good morning, Chairman and members of the board.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So my name is Christine Boshin, and I'm a senior environmental scientist working in the construction and industrial stormwater programs. Today I'm going to be giving you a preview of some exciting changes that are about to hit the construction program here in the Bay Area as well as around the state. So for the first time since 1999, the state of California has a reissued construction general stormwater permit. This updated permit, which goes into effect this July, will bring with it significant changes for the construction industry and for all of our staff working in the program. But before I get into that, let me back up a bit and go over the basics of this permit. It's a statewide general NPDES stormwater permit, and it applies to all projects that disturb an acre or more of soil. Historically, the construction general permit regulates by what the discharger does to protect water quality rather than by end-of-pipe effluent measurements. Practices or structures the discharger uses to protect water quality are referred to as best management practices. Here in Region 2, we have approximately 1,600 sites enrolled under the permit, and those sites have a combined total disturbed area of 26,000 acres, or, easier for me to wrap my head around, 40.7 square miles, about just roughly bigger than Walnut Creek and San Ramon combined. Historically, our region was successful in protecting water quality from construction activities by using a three-pronged approach of education and outreach, inspections, and enforcement. As for education and outreach, every year we held erosion control workshops in nearly all Bay Area counties, and we published a field manual for erosion and sediment controls. Our staff had a big field presence, logging in about 300 inspections a year, and we took 10 to 15 monetary enforcement actions every year. We've gotten to the point that things were looking pretty good out there. So, for that reason, and because we were going through staffing reductions, our focus shifted away from construction stormwater. However, in the past 2 years, we refocused in that area. From 2008 to present, we performed over 220 inspections. Unfortunately, what we're seeing these days are not looking good. There is a big difference between how best management practices should be employed and maintained and what we are actually seeing in the field. In the overwhelming majority of sites we've seen, there is no protection at all, or what is installed is put in incorrectly and not maintained. I'm going to be showing you some photos to illustrate good and bad management practices. I want to qualify that all of the good examples are, unfortunately, from outside of our region. The bad examples are all here from the Bay Area and were taken in the past two rainy seasons. For example, let's take erosion control. Erosion control, that is, covering dirt so it stays in place and does not mobilize in the rain, is the single most important and effective tool in keeping sediments out of our waterways. Here's an example of what we should see. Bare areas are being covered with a product that is appropriate to both the slope of the site and the length of time the area is not going to be worked. However, time after time, this is what we do see. Swaths of bare areas that have no cover and are ready to mobilize in the wind or the rain. Taking another example, inlet protection, what we want to see are structures that will interrupt the flow of water enough to slow that water down so the sediment carried in it will settle out. Then, we would expect to see that dropped sediment cleaned on a regular basis and the best management practice refreshed and maintained. Instead, we typically see no inlet protection at all, or we see inlet protection that hasn't been refreshed and maintained. It is, isn't that lovely?
So I think it's smaller than that guy.
I would imagine. So for another example, let's look at sediment controls. Sediment controls can either filter or slow water flow, again, with the goal of removing sediments from the water. Here's a good example of a site that has sediment controls at regularly placed intervals in combination with good erosion control. What we see at sites in the Bay Area, however, in most cases is like this photo, where sediment controls are incorrectly installed and not maintained. As you can see in the circled area, this straw wattle has not been keyed in, and water has been able to undercut it, and the soil has eroded. The silt fence, which should be installed parallel to the contours of the land, in this case is concentrating flow and increasing erosion. In other cases, we'll see sites that only have sediment control, which is not sufficiently protected without also having erosion controls. 60% of the active sites in the Bay Area have less than 5 acres disturbed surface. So as you're driving around in the rain and see these sites, you might think that construction control is really not such a big issue. However, when you think of the big picture, you realize how significant the impact is if these sites are not sufficiently protected. And I took this picture 2 weeks ago. So back to the updated permit. Just what is so special about it that will help us solve the problems we face at construction sites? The updated permit spells out more clearly what is required, and that gives us a faster path to bringing sites into compliance. The old version of the permit gave a basic outline for compliance. It identified the range of pollutants, visual and non-visual, that are likely to be at construction sites. It gave a general skeleton outline of what categories of best management practices should be employed. And it suggested to the discharger when self-monitoring should be performed to check on BMP effectiveness. What is challenging for us regulators is that the old version of the permit left details to the dischargers. This has meant a lot of room for arguing over how much is enough, especially considering that we're not physically able to actively watch over all of our sites through the rainy season. The reissued permit is a better tool for us because it spells out just how much is enough. The reissued permit is over 200 pages long, and there are many pertinent aspects that I could tell you about if I had a couple hours, but I don't, so I'm going to focus in on a few highlights. The flashiest aspect of the reissued permit is, for the first time, we have numeric compliance markers instead of just requiring BMPs. For the highest risk level sites, we actually have effluent limitations, and for medium and high risk sites, we have numeric action levels. But even more importantly, and perhaps where we are going to see the majority of our regulatory activity, the reissued permit clarifies how far the discharger needs to go with best management practices, training for responsible staff, and self-monitoring before and after rain events. To give you a flavor of the specificity of the reissued permit, let's look at erosion control requirements. For low-risk sites, all disturbed areas that are not going to be worked for 14 days or more, as well as all finished slopes, open space, utility backfill, and completed lots, must be covered. For medium and high-risk sites, all of the above applies, plus they must use an effective combination of erosion and sediment controls for all active construction areas. For staff, the reissued permit is very exciting in that it provides us with a multitude of different regulatory focus points. The database, which has been updated concurrently, and Dr. Singh, I'd like to point out to you that actually all permittees are going to be uploading their registration documents electronically as well as their annual reports, and it's going to be a lot of help for us too in finding information. Just wanted to address your question. At any rate, the database, which has been updated concurrently, will let us sort projects by their size and their risk level so we can better prioritize our inspections. With our inspections, we can pick a theme to follow through, such as looking at how well sites are implementing their best management practices, whether they are producing and using their rain event action plans, or whether they follow up with corrections after having numeric action level exceedances. We can focus our paper reviews too, for example, to check that risk assessment calculations were done correctly and whether stormwater pollution prevention plans are adequate. And lastly, it is possible that this program will generate mandatory minimum penalties if our high-risk level sites have violations that fit the MMP formula. So in looking at our present-day regulatory challenge, we are asking ourselves the following questions. How do we bring the Bay Area construction community back into compliance? And where does the problem lie? Is it a matter of the community not having the know-how to comply, or is the community not having the will? The answer is that we need to use the same three-pronged approach we used last decade. As for outreach, this fiscal year we gave 7 workshops in 5 different counties. We sent letters to all our current enrollees announcing the reissued permit and explaining how to enroll in it. As for knowledge, the materials and expertise are certainly out there. In addition to our own erosion control manual, the California Stormwater Quality Association has updated its BMP manual to meet the reissued permit requirements. As we speak, statewide mandatory training courses for SWIP preparers and SWIP practitioners are being developed. As for inspections, we've already ramped up our inspection program, and this summer we will update our forms and procedures to meet the reissued permit. So, as for the last step in reattaining water quality protection in the Bay Area, what we need to do is help our discharger community regain their will to comply with the construction general permit. And that concludes my presentation, and I think I probably have 30 seconds for questions.
You did a great job. Thank you.
I have a question, a simple question.
Yes.
I like the last slide, by the way.
Thank you.
What I was going to say, that I'm really concerned about these storm drains. Close to my home, I was walking last night and just trying to get a little exercise along the footpath. And then there is just grated storm drain, and on the side also there is a side opening storm drain. The opening, you know, the two combined. And then I saw that these kids are walking and they have cans and bottles. They're throwing in that hole, you know, and there is no protection to stop it, you know. And that's going to clog up probably. So I said, I stopped over there and I said, listen, why are you throwing it? It will clog up the storm drain. Throw it somewhere else. So they just got mad at me and they threw on the street. So I picked up myself, I got a plastic bag. And when I'm walking along, I picked up some paper. So what I did, I picked it up and I took it and threw it in the garbage can. But there is a danger over here because these side opening storm drains, they're completely unprotected. And these people walking on the sidewalk, they're throwing bottles and cans in there. And I don't know how to control these young kids over here. They're completely out of control and they don't feel any responsibility. I don't know.
That's another subject, Dr. Singh.
Yeah. This gets into our trash controls, which would be another hour or two. But
I picked up some at the plaza this morning walking for coffee. So we all do our duty. But I think more important on the construction stormwater permit, you have to take into consideration right now the bids are getting lower and lower and lower for construction projects because of the situation of the economy. And I see a breakdown in the combination because of the building. There's really not a lot of building going on other than some isolated spots, but I don't think there's too many more housing developments going in. That's not our target right now, which we worked years and years on. And I think the target really is our smaller projects. And again, when contractors are bidding, I mean, we're seeing them come in for nothing out there on some projects, and just to keep people employed. So I think that's a real sensitive level that when we're doing outreach, we got to say, hey, look, you have to include these best management practices for enforcement. So that's just my quick comment. Board Member Peacock?
I concur with the chairman's remarks about the low bid problem, and that's going to be a big issue. And that, the only reason I ask this question is to clarify. In the write-up, we talk about all risk levels have required minimum best best practices. Isn't that an oxymoron? Isn't a best practice a best practice? I mean, is there a lesser best practice, or what does that mean?
You know, I don't know if I can really explain the lingo here, but just to give you an on-the-ground example. So I was at a construction site, I showed a slide of it here, where they hadn't included erosion control at all in their stormwater pollution prevention plan, and probably not in their bid either. And so that would be a management practice, a required management practice that wasn't there, and they were relying only on some straw wattles around their site, which was right next to the creek, actually, and it wasn't doing the job to keep the sediment out of the creek. So BMP, best management practices, it's the jargon that's now used to describe the suite of things that people can do, structural and non-structural, and it not being there is obviously not best.
It's also who's interpreting it right now, too. We're trying to do best management practice, but other agencies are coming in and saying, we don't like that type of practice. So that's a whole other argument.
If I can jump in, I think part of the answer to your question is that some sites are pose a lower risk in terms of the amount of runoff that they would have and the amount of dirt it would carry. And some sites, if they have steeper slopes and are right by a creek, they would have higher risk. And that means that they would have their best management practices would be more thorough.
So thank you. I think
that's where you get into different tiers of operations.
Yeah. This is a numerical limitation. How are you going to measure that? You measure the flow or the sediment in the flow?
They're going to be measuring for two different things. Let me see if I have a slide for you on that. Okay, so they're going to be looking at turbidity in the flow and pH in the flow.
All right. Thank you. Board Member Moore? Board Member Singh, we have to make a quick
question. Yes, I have a question. No. I have done consulting on BMP, and I have worked on that. We had a computer program, only work on the hydrology, sediment control, etc., etc. But I never had a risk management, you know, that we didn't have a program on risk management, okay? Maybe this is something you have developed some tool about that, or what?
Bruce, would you like me to put this together in an EO item, or do we have time for a few more answers?
That may be the better approach, to put it together, just to try to describe, because this permit, it is new, that has three different levels of risk, and we can go into that a little bit, and why don't we put that into an EO report item for you. And the important thing here to note is that this updated permit becomes effective July 1, so it's something we'll be looking to apply for the coming season. But I think it's very clear that as Christine says, that we've noted this decline in performance, and the updated permit provides a laundry list of tools that we'll be able to use to combine with our ongoing outreach and our use. I just wanted to show off as a visual, this is what we put together 10 years ago as sort of the Bible of the sport of a field manual, and it's gotten very significant use over the last 10 years. The challenge is we have all these outreach materials, and we expected people to be using them, but much as we found that it's the implementation and then it's the maintenance. I mean, they may have inlet controls, but it's not good enough just to put them there and walk away for the rest of the year. The sediment will come in, or as that picture showed, you may have only gravel in there because all of the fine material has washed through the hole.
Yeah, Board Member Schroeder, please.
Yeah, just real quick with respect to inspections. Are you working with cities and counties in their engineering or their building inspection departments? Because they're out there all the time.
We do. There's a delicate balance between making sure that we're not overstepping their compliance issues with their municipal stormwater permit. So if we know the inspectors, we have a good working relationship, and we've passed it by our municipal counterparts, hey, the city's doing a good job, right? Yes, okay. Then we can interact with them fairly easily. And we do share information and take their information about sites and move forward on enforcement as makes sense.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
That's a very important aspect, because with Christine and her two staff dedicated to the inspections, obviously we can't be everywhere. We rely on the locals, And the locals have come to rely on us. If they have an issue, they'll bring it to our attention, and potentially we would do the enforcement.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Christine, for everything. As I mentioned earlier this morning, if you were not in the room, we are going to take a brief as possible break. We do need to meet Vice Chair and myself with legal counsel, and we will have a break here. Then we will reconvene, do a swearing in, and I would say, about 12:30, we will take a lunch break. And so wherever we are at that time, hopefully in 10-15 minutes.
Well, but we do need to
10 minutes or so.
Tables.
We have some table adjustments also, so quick break.
Prosecution.